what I want to persuade you of today is that among the forms of social arrangement one ought to take seriously as possibilities, one of them is society with the institutions of private property without government, what's sometimes called anarcho-capitalism. And there are really two halves to the argument. The first half is why government works poorly, why having government in charge of things like making laws might not be a good idea, and the second half is why it is possible to have an alternative. That is, that the argument against government is one that probably all of you are familiar with, because the same arguments show up whether you're talking about vouchers versus public schools, about socialist agriculture versus private agriculture, government regulation, and so forth. There are a variety of reasons why many people, not all, but many people believe that governments do a bad job of producing things, that the fact the Soviet Union collapsed was not an accident, and was not mainly due to its being a tyranny, but mainly due to its being a socialist tyranny. And if you think about it, the reasons to think governments do things badly don't only apply to the things we usually argue about. So if you think you have been convinced that having the government make cars is going to result in low-quality cars at high cost, or having the government control agriculture is going to result in people going hungry, then you ought to ask yourself whether having the government control the business of making laws is going to result in badly designed laws, and having government control the business of protecting people from lawbreakers is going to result in quite a lot of lawbreaking. If you think governments do a bad job of doing things, then you ought to at least ask yourself, what about the most fundamental things that we expect governments to do? There is a long tradition, what we think of as a classical liberal limited government view, which holds that for most purposes, private voluntary market arrangements are the best solution, but that there is a set of minimal functions of government which can only be provided by government. So the argument essentially is, yes, private property and exchange and all that work nicely within a framework in which the law is being enforced, but those same mechanisms can't actually produce the framework. And if that's true, even if the government does a bad job of making laws, better bad laws than no laws at all, and that then seems like an argument for why anarchy should be ruled out in the discussion. And I'm going to argue that that's wrong, and that one can plausibly imagine market institutions producing and enforcing law, and indeed that to some degree, in some context, we observe essentially market institutions producing and enforcing law. I'll come back to that. But let me start out with the case against government, the sort of negative, as it were, half of my argument. And I want to start out with the concept of market failure. How many people here believe they know what the term market failure means? Crazy. All right. I won't ask you to define it. That would pose the risk that if your definition is different than mine, you might get embarrassed. So let me explain what I think the idea means. And the crucial thing is that it's not about markets. That is a problem which exists on markets, on ordinary private markets, but exists in lots of other places as well. That market failure fundamentally is a situation where individual rationality fails to lead to group rationality. That the basic economic assumption is that the best way of predicting people's behavior is to assume that they act rationally, that they take the actions that best achieve their objectives. And what market failure points out is that there are some situations where if each of us acts rationally, if each of us takes the actions that best achieve his objectives, we'll all be worse off. And my standard example for this is to imagine that it's about 1,000 years ago, and you are one of 10,000 men with spears in a line, and you're all facing that way with your spears, and the reason you're doing it is that some thousands of men on horseback who also have spears are coming in this direction. And you do a very quick cost-benefit calculation. And you say to yourself, if all of us stand and hold our spears solidly, with luck, we'll break their charge. And some of us will die, but most of us will live. Whereas if we run away, horses run faster than we do. Therefore, we ought to stand. I'm sorry, I made a mistake. I said we. I don't get to decide what those guys do. I just get to decide what I do. If the other people in the line are going to stand, 9,999 people are just about as likely to stop a charge as 10,000 are. So my running away will have a very, very small effect on the chance that the charge will go through. And if I run, I'm not going to be one of the ones who gets killed. On the other hand, if they're going to run, my only hope is to run faster. So whether I think the rest of my line is going to stand or the rest of my line is going to run, the rational thing for me to do is run. Everybody makes the same calculations. All of us run and most of us die. Welcome to the dark side of rationality. All right, that's a simple illustration of a situation where rational individual action leads, as it were, to irrational group action. And the examples you're probably familiar with from economic tests are things like externalities, where people don't take into account the cost of vehicles and others in deciding what to do, public goods, where things don't get produced because the individual producer can't control who gets it and therefore can't charge for it. Some of you may be familiar with adverse selection. There are a variety of other contexts in which market failure appears. The point, however, that's often missed is that market failure exists in lots of contexts other than markets. And indeed, I just gave you one example of why a medieval army runs away even though they get killed by doing so, is an example of market failure, even though there's no money, no formal exchange, none of the stuff we normally think of as markets going on. Furthermore, if you think about it for a while, as they sometimes say, it takes a candidate to beat a candidate. And if you are thinking of market failure as an argument against having something done by the market, whether that something is producing steel or education or laws, you've got to be considering some alternative, some other way of producing. Well, the usual alternative is government producing things. And if you think about it, the mechanisms by which government does things are themselves shot through with market failure. And let me start out with a very simple example. What I think of is the civics class model of democracy. The question is, why should we expect democracy to work? Why should we expect our political institutions to result in the government doing the right thing? Mm-hmm. Don't expect it to do the right thing, well, then maybe we ought to go back to the market for whatever particular thing we discuss. And the civics class model of democracy says, if the politicians do the wrong thing, the voters will vote them out, therefore the politicians have to do the things that are in the interest of the public, therefore government will work. And the problem with that is that for some reason politicians never announce I'm doing the wrong thing. They never introduce a bill into Congress which says a bill to make farmers richer and everybody else poorer, even though every year without fail a farm bill with that purpose is introduced. Then naturally enough, when you are passing legislation, you put it in a way designed to make it look as though everybody benefits, or at least as close to that as you can possibly. In order for the individual voter to know whether the candidate who's up today did good or bad things over the last 2 years or 4 years or 6 years, the voter would have to spend considerable time and effort figuring out the effects of the bill that candidate voted for, finding out what bills he voted for and against, finding out why he voted for and against them. You might, after all, vote against a good bill because you thought you could replace it with a better bill. What return do you get for the effort needed to be, so to speak, an informed voter? All right, the model implicitly assumes informed voters. Casual observation finds that we don't have informed voters. Right? Sometimes when I have a class of undergraduates, I ask how many of them know the name of their congressman, and it's generally about 50%. Very hard to keep track of what he's doing if you don't know his name. So what return do I get for the time and effort I would spend on being the well-informed voter who this sort of model of democracy is? And the answer is I get no return at all. Because in a large population democracy, the chance that my vote for president will alter the outcome of the election is very roughly about 1 in 10 million, maybe 1 in 5 million for optimistic. One chance in 10 million of getting the better candidate is not worth the time and effort necessary to figure out who the better candidate is. It makes far more sense to pick the candidate who I like listening to, or who makes me feel good, or who my friends and neighbors approve of, and therefore will think well of me when I say I'm supporting him, or any reason other than actually figuring out who will be a good president or a good congressman, a good representative or senator. So the result is what economists in the field of public choice refer to as rational ignorance. Rational ignorance is not knowing things when the cost of the information is greater than the value. Very common situation. After all, most of us are rationally ignorant about almost everything, given how wide the range of things one can know is. And in particular, voters are normally rationally ignorant about the people they're voting for. and therefore that model of how democracy is supposed to work can work, and I think pretty clearly it doesn't work. Let me give you a second model, sort of a more sophisticated version, which is at least a little more plausible, but also has difficulties. And that's interest group democracy. And the theory goes here that you have a group of people who will be benefited by some law that's passed. And so they get together and they go to various politicians and say, look, we'd like to buy some legislation. If you will support the steel tariff, we, the steel industry, will raise money to contribute to your campaign. We will get the steel workers unions and raise volunteer workers to work for you. We will do various things to get you reelected. You like that. So we, in effect, will buy legislation. And, of course, we'll only buy legislation that benefits us. So that's the pressure to get good laws passed. And the problem with that turns out, oddly enough, to be the public good problem. As economists use the term, not as non-economists use it. The public good problem is that if you have a good which, if it's produced, everybody can get it, or all the members of a pre-existing group can get it, then the producer has no way of getting paid for producing it. All right? Imagine that I am producing a radio broadcast. That's a good example because the public good is actually privately produced. I produce a radio broadcast. The normal mechanism for producing things is you say to the customer, here it is, if you want to pay me for it. If customers are willing to pay enough to more than cover the cost of production, it pays me to produce it. That's a standard mechanism you're probably all familiar with. Doesn't work for a public good. It's a public good. If I put out that broadcast, you can listen to it whether or not you pay for it. We'll come back to radio broadcasts later because they're a nice example of one of the tricks by which you privately produce something. Now think about lobbying for legislation. That I'm the president of a small steel mill, and U.S. Steel comes to me and says, look, we've decided that each of us should kick in $100,000 to the re-election campaign of Senator Smith, because Senator Smith's the good guy who got the steel tariff through and thus benefited our industry. And I say, well, you know, I'm absolutely in favor of your contributing $100,000 to Mr. Smith's re-election campaign. I hope you persuade lots of other people to do it, but the amount of money my firm would kick in is not going to make the difference between his getting re-elected and not getting re-elected, so I think I'll sit this one out. That's the public good problem. All right. I, as somebody in the industry, will get the benefit of the tariffs, will get the benefit of the legislation that other firms are buying, whether or not I can do the same. That implies that the amount the steel industry will be able to raise to buy a tariff will be less than the value of the industry of the tariff. Does that make sense? Because some firms, maybe some of the larger firms, will chip in something, but at least some people will choose to be free riders on the effort. The problem is larger the bigger the public is. Imagine a public good which benefits three people if it passed. All right, suppose there are only three steel firms, for example. It's not very hard for three firms to get together and say, look, I'll chip in if you don't, and if you refuse, the whole thing falls through. So by that mechanism and others, a public good for a very small and well-organized public, you can in fact raise money to produce it roughly comparable to the values of the people who benefit by it. A public good for a very large public, on the other hand, that becomes impossible. So as a sort of a rough rule of thumb, we would say that the bigger the public provided it is that a public good benefits, the smaller the fraction of the benefit that can actually be raised to buy the good. Make sense to people? General argument. Now, let's go back to the steel tariff. The beneficiaries, you're making an auto tariff, but don't know. We're short of auto companies at the moment, but making an auto tariff a few years ago. The auto tariff benefits whatever it was then, three or four companies, each of which has got a board of directors and a president to represent its welfare. It benefits the members of the United Auto Workers. They've got a president of the union to represent their activities. It benefits the mayor of Detroit because Detroit will be a richer city if their auto industry does well. Maybe the governor of Michigan. Maybe a few other people. So you've got maybe 10 or 12 people who have to get together to contribute money and other valuable things to buy an auto tariff. How about the other side of it? The auto tariff injures all people who are customers for autos in the U.S. because it makes them more expensive by reducing foreign competition. It injures less obviously all producers of U.S. export goods because if we import fewer cars, we'll export less wheat. for reasons that have been well understood, I suppose, pretty nearly since Ricardo worked out the theory of preparedness advantage 200 years ago, the net effect of the tariff almost inevitably is to make the U.S. poorer, not richer. So the benefit to the steel industry is almost certain to be less than the cost to the various losers within the U.S. population. However, the steel industry is a concentrated interest group. So if it gains $10 billion, it can probably raise at least $1 billion of that to contribute to politicians. The victims of the steel tariff are dispersed interest group. So if they lose $100 billion, they can't raise anything like $1 billion to oppose the steel tariff. Hence, the tariff, economically speaking, is unprofitable. It imposes net costs. Politically speaking, it's profitable. So what you would expect if we take the fancy model of democracy, interest group democracy, is that interest groups, benefits and costs to interest groups will be much more heavily weighted for concentrated interest groups than for dispersed interest groups, with the result that a politician who can create a law which produces a benefit for a concentrated interest group at the expense of the dispersed interest group will gain by doing so, even if on net that law makes people worse off. And, of course, we observed that Ricardo worked out the theory of comparative advantage 200 years ago. Essentially, any competent economist since has understood it. He wasn't a competent economist. And yet, with two notable exceptions, there has been no policy in the last 200 years that has followed through the logic of complete free trade. Those exceptions being Britain in the 19th century and Hong Kong in the 20th century, two of the most successful economies that we have ever had. You can see, I think, the same pattern in a variety of other contexts. Gary Becker, economist of Chicago, has this sort of general rule about farm policy. And his rule is that the countries of the world are divided into two kinds. There are countries like the U.S. and European countries where farmers are a very small minority of the population. And there are countries like much of the third world where poor peasants are the bulk of the population. In countries where farmers are a small minority of the population, the purpose of farm policy is to make farmers rich at the expense of the rest of the population. And in countries where there are a large part of the population, the purpose of the farm policy is to make farmers poor in order to buy the support of the urban mob with cheap food, basically. It's a pretty good rule. I think New Zealand is an exception. I think New Zealand neither specially taxes nor specially subsidizes agriculture, but so their experiments are. So that, again, fits the pattern of the concentrated interest of first interest argument, that you would expect that where farmers are few, they are a concentrated, well-organized interest, so benefiting them high up on the political schedule where there are many the other way around. Let me give you one further problem, we could give a longer list, for why the political mechanism is likely to work poorly. The examples I've been describing all come out of market failure. All right. Why are we rational agents? Because collecting information to be an informed voter is itself a public good activity. If I'm an informed voter, that benefits everybody in the country. I get a tiny bit of that benefit. Why does interest group politics give the wrong results? Because lobbying runs into a public good problem. Let me give a third class of problems, and this has to do with time horizon. Then it is often sort of asserted in political oratory that we've got to have the government intervene somewhere because it's got long time horizons and the market has short time horizons. And the truth is precisely the opposite. And it's opposite for a reason that should be clear to any economist. How do we get long-term planning within a market economy? Anybody want to tell me what's the one essential requirement for rational individuals to engage in long-term planning, to invest today for things that will give you a return in 20 or 40 years? What do you think? Let's suppose I'm growing walnut trees, black walnuts, really pretty lumber, very, very valuable, but they're slow-growing trees. And I'm thinking of planting a field with black walnut trees, and it'll be 40 years until they're harvested. Unfortunately, I'm 64. So when they are harvested, unless I'm very lucky and there's a lot of medical progress, I'm going to be dead. So you might suppose that therefore no elderly person would ever plant black walnut trees. But you'd be wrong. Because if I plant them now, in 20 years, when I'm still probably alive, I can sell 20-year-old black walnut trees to someone else who plans to hold them for another 20 years at a price reflecting the fact that they're halfway harvested. So that means that people, rational, self-interested, selfish people, can plan well beyond their own lifetimes in terms of economic decisions and making investments now for returns in the future, with that. Provided there's one condition in this, and the one condition is your property rights. If I believe that there's a significant chance each year of the next 40 years, either that the government will decide that walnut trees are a national resource and seize them, or that some enterprising private individual will drive onto my field in the middle of the night with a chainsaw and drive off with a couple of logs, in either of those cases, I'm going to have to discount the return for my investment in black walnut trees year by year by the chance of losing. All right. So the more insecure my property rights are, the less it's in my interest to engage in long-term planning. That if I'm considering one project that gives me a return in 1 year versus a project that gives me a return in 20 years, the 20-year project has to pay off much better than the 1 year project per year in a world of insecure property rights, because it has to compensate me for the risk of being expropriated during that period. Now think about the political market, the marketplace in which politicians are at. Politicians have very insecure property rights. As I used to put it a couple of presidents back, Clinton could rent out the White House, but he couldn't sell it. If you're a politician and you do politically expensive things today, they will produce politically beneficial things 20 years down the road. It will. You are a very foolish politician. Because 20 years down the road, your term will have long expired. Whoever is then in power, who has a 50% chance of being a member of the opposite party, will take the credit for whatever the good results of your sacrifices was. And you probably won't even last out more than one term, because you'll get the blame for whatever the costs were that you imposed to get those long-term results. Now, of course, you might reply, but when I make the short-term sacrifices, the voters will say, wonderful, we're suffering now, we're going to benefit in 20 years, and they'll vote me in. But the voters, remember, are rationally ignorant. The voters don't actually know. Of course, if anything bad happens, I will try to persuade the voters that I'm making sacrifices for the long term. Because the great thing about the long term is you can't see it. And therefore, I can lie about it much more easily. It's hard to lie about whether or not people are hungry today. You think about the history of the Soviet Union. Stalin's line for, I suppose, decades was, why is the workers' paradise not a paradise? Because we are suffering today and making sacrifices so that our children will be richer than the captives. That was the line. And he could run it for 20 years or so. Eventually people stopped believing him, but for a long time it's at least halfway plausible because you can see the hungry, the fact you're hungry today, but not whether or not you get it in. So a politician certainly has an incentive to claim he's planning for the long term. That doesn't require him to actually do it. Therefore, we would expect, but I think we actually observe, that political decisions are made mostly with an eye on the next election, and with very, very little weight given to actual future returns, save as a rhetorical device if you think you can persuade the voters that whatever you want to do is going to give them some benefit a long time in the future. Alright, so the conclusion I'm arguing for, and sort of a general conclusion, and obviously at this length of time I shouldn't persuade anybody, but I should maybe give you arguments that you might later persuade yourself. The general argument is that we can expect governments to do a very bad job of the sort of things we want markets to do, a very bad job of allocating resources and making decisions. If that's right, then in particular we should expect governments to do a bad job of making laws. That happens to be something that we take it for granted governments will do. And maybe doing it badly is better than not doing it at all, but we shouldn't be surprised if we observe that the government spends enormous resources trying to punish people for smoking marijuana, that the government simultaneously subsidizes and taxes the same things in different ways, that in lots of ways governments behave in what's being done by these situations. Is there an alternative? So the second half of the argument starts out with the claim that even if market arrangements, which I haven't really discussed in any detail, I assume that all of you are familiar with the sort of very simple level argument about why markets why, if you don't have market failure, why markets work, and goods get produced if they're worth more to the consumers than they cost to produce, that's the rule we want, and so forth. But the claim is that that only works within a framework where you have established property rights laws and so forth, and that itself can't be produced without a government. We know that claim is false. We know that claim is false because we observe an extensive marketplace in international trade, and there is no supranational legal authority. Right? We know that firms do business with other firms, that governments do business with other governments and with firms, that there is no way, if I lend money to the government of Venezuela, there is no court in which I can force the government of Venezuela to pay that money back. Because governments have sovereignty. And yet, nonetheless, we observe an active market in which people and governments lend money to governments. We observe an active international market in which most of the legal disputes are settled via arbitration, in which there are private firms and organizations that are in the business of arbitrating commercial disputes. Now, it's true that at the moment, most major countries are signatory to treaties saying that their domestic court systems will enforce arbitrated verdicts if there was an arbitration clause in the contract that's being enforced. That has not always been true. It isn't true now of all countries. Nonetheless, as I say, we observe an active international market. So clearly there are some alternative ways in which legal rules can be generated and enforced. There are other examples. All of you have lived all of your life in a world of privately generated and enforced laws, which we call norms. Alright? One of the ways I like to put it is that there is no legal rule at the moment which prevents me from stripping down to the waist, from taking off my shirt and undershirt and jacket and getting the lecture in the next one. And yet it would be a foolish thing for me to do because the norms of this society say respectable professors don't do things like that. I would therefore suffer stigma as a result of that change in other people's opinions about me, stories would be told, rumors would be passed, and so forth, and I would be worse off as a result. Well, all societies have that working, whether or not they also have a law in the normal sense. They all have systems of informal norms of various sorts, enforced by various informal mechanisms. Sometimes they're enforced by mechanisms that we would think of as forced. There's a fascinating book by Robert Ellison, a Yale law professor, called Order Without Law, which is describing a system of functioning private law a couple of hours from here in Shasta County, California, which is an agricultural, mostly rural county, in which it turns out that there is a system of norms of neighborly behavior which for some purposes trumps the laws of the state of California. That there are, for example, rules on what happens if my cattle get into your field and damage your crop. They are not the same as the rules of the state of California. They are what people actually do. One of the reasons is that one of the strongest norms of neighborly behavior is that neighbors don't sue neighbors. So if I try to make you do what the law says you should do, I've already lost, because everybody will regard me as having broken the rules and therefore being the sort of person they don't want to invite over to dinner, to have their kids play with, to have their wife take rings with, whatever the relevant social norms are. It turns out that under the norms of neighborly behavior, I can sometimes do illegal things to enforce those norms. So that, for example, the norms say that if your cattle come into my field and do damage and I call you up to tell you about it, you're supposed to be apologetic, you're supposed to promptly retrieve the cattle, you're supposed to offer to help make up any damage that's been done, help me replant my tomatoes or whatever it is. If you don't do that, my first recourse is informal training, basically passing the word to your bad neighbor. If you keep not doing it, the next time your cattle stray onto my territory, instead of calling you up, I open the gate, drive your cattle out of my property, head them in the direction away from where you live, drive them for a couple of miles, and then go home, and leave it for you to try to find your stray cattle. That is surely an illegal activity under the laws of the state of California. It is, however, an activity sanctioned under the norms of neighborly behavior in Shasta County. So that would be a second example of that. If you go back in history, as you may know, a good deal of our commercial code, the Uniform Commercial Code, the UCC, ultimately comes out of the Fair Courts Law. That in medieval Europe, there were trade fairs at particular places at particular times, and the people who came to those trade fairs from all over Europe needed ways of settling their disputes. And so they developed a code of private law, which was enforced by reputational mechanisms, by the fact that if you were held by the fair court to have violated your contract and did not pay whatever penalty was set, the word would be spread that you weren't a safe person to trade with, to do business with. That cost you enough so that people normally obeyed the decisions of the fair court. So that's yet another case in which you had a system of private law. So the claim I'm making is that the general impossibility of privately generated law has to be wrong. There's no historical evidence. Now, there is a second half of the argument. And the second half of the argument says, aside from the basic framework, there are certain very important goods which can't be produced by the market because of market failure problems. So that probably the strongest such argument is for national defense. And the claim would be that if you spend money defending your country against foreign enemies, that's defending everybody in the country, you only get a small part of the benefits, standard public good problem, and so forth. But it also can be argued that there are other public goods. People claim, I think not very persuasively, that education is a public good, perhaps more persuasively that basic research is a public good, and so forth. And then the claim is concerned. So now let me flip it and try to give the answer. And I want to start by sketching an imaginary society in which you have no government but you have law. And the way the society works is as follows. There are firms which are in the business of protecting individual rights. And essentially everybody in the society chooses to be a customer of one such firm because you don't want to be vulnerable to people robbing you and killing you. So I pay my annual fee to a rights protection agency, and they agree to check my business. Now, this raises a problem that's obvious to everybody who thinks about this problem, the situation more than about 5 minutes. And that is, what happens when a customer of one such agency gets into a dispute with a customer of another such agency? So that my agency has installed a closed-circuit television or some equivalent in my house to observe robbers. They see someone break in my house to steal my television. They say, aha, we recognize your face on that television. And therefore, would you please return Mr. Friedman's television along with a 150-month penalty to pay us for the trouble of finding out who you were and getting it back? And you reply, I've never seen Mr. Friedman, I've never seen his house, I've never been in his house, must have been someone else who looked like me, and by the way, I have a rights enforcement agency too. And if you send some goons over to take my television, which you claim is his television, I will call out my rights enforcement agency and they will protect me. And that looks like a scenario that leads to a violent conflict between the two agencies. And that's the argument that various people have made for why this can't work. But it's wrong. And it's wrong because these firms are not macho government gangs. They are private firms trying to make money. And warfare is very expensive. And the firms, our two agencies, are going to anticipate this problem. They can work it out as well as we can. And there are some obvious solutions. There's a short-run solution, which is that when my firm calls up your firm because we have a problem, we start discussing whether we can find a neutral arbitrator to settle it without violence. But that's sort of a temporary answer, and the long-term answer is that we agree on our arbitrator in advance. So that my firm and your firm know we're operating in the same territory, we know our customers may come into clashes with each other, so we say, look, there's this private court over there, a private arbitration agency. They're pretty sensible people, they do a good job of settling disputes. Why don't we agree in advance that any disputes between our customers will be settled by them, and that both of us will enforce those rights? Okay. So that's sort of the simple, basic framework. And notice that we've got two layers of private firms here, the rights enforcement agencies, and then the arbitration agencies. And each pair of rights enforcement agencies find it in their interest to contract with a arbitration agency. Not necessarily all the same. Now, the next question that should occur to you is, well, that's all very well, but what enforces those contracts? That after all, if the arbitrator rules against your customer, why don't you say, well, that's very nice, but he's decided to back out of the contract and be lost. And the answer to that is something that's sometimes referred to as the discipline of constant dealings. That we in fact know, we observe pretty routinely in many contexts, that if firms are dealing with each other in the long term, they have an incentive to keep their word, to keep their contracts without any court enforcement, because if not, the other party won't trust you in the future and therefore won't trust you. And the enforcement agencies are repeat players. My enforcement agency knows perfectly well that if when they lose a case, they refuse to accept the verdict, then the next case, the other agency won't accept the verdict if it goes the other way, and they're back having to fight each other with every conflict. That's an expensive way of doing business, and pretty soon they'll have no customers, because the other agencies out there who are run by sensible people have all agreed on arbitration and are keeping their word, and therefore produce a more reliable kind of price protection at a lower cost, which means they get all. So that's the basic logic of the argument that I'm describing. And before going into various arguments I've heard with the sum, as well as many that I've heard before, let me run through a couple of its attractive features. And one of the most attractive features is that, like other markets, it is going to produce goods which the producers have an incentive to make the goods that consumers want. So that, imagine that I'm an arbitration agency, and I'm a rights enforcement agency, and I'm trying to decide what arbitration agencies I should try to arrange arbitration. One of the things I'm going to ask is, what's the law code that they enforce? What are the rules they use to settle disputes? If one of them, why do I care? Well, I don't care, actually. But my customers care. Right? Part of what I'm selling my customers is essentially the statement, if you end up with a dispute, odds are 30% it'll go to arbitration agency A, because we've got contracts with other agencies covering 30% of the market specifying agency A, 15% agency B, et cetera, et cetera. This is the bundle of legal rules we can affect negotiators for you. Well, if some agencies turn out to settle cases more quickly at lower costs, with on the whole what people find more satisfactory results than others, there is a market incentive for the rights enforcement agencies to patronize them, and there's thus a market incentive for the arbitration agencies to try and design good law, to try to design a law that individual customers will want to live under. Customers can't have complete control over law because the legal rule between me and you is the same as being you and me. But you can have some control to the extent that agencies are willing and accepted to bid for different law codes. Imagine, to run through it a little bit from the standpoint of an economist, let us suppose that there is some issue of law which customers disagree on. And for simplicity, let's make it the death penalty. So some people think that they would like to be under a legal rule where if somebody kills them, they'll be executed, because that makes it less likely that they will kill them. Other people say, I don't like that legal rule because I'm afraid I might kill somebody or might be falsely convicted of killing somebody and getting executed. Maybe there are other reasons. People have moral feelings on this as well. Doesn't matter for my argument. For whatever reason, some customers like a death penalty, some customers don't. My agency, after polling its customers, decides that on the whole we make more money if we can guarantee them death penalty if they got executed. If they got murdered. Your firm, after polling its customers, decides it could make more money because it has different customers if it could guarantee you there wasn't going to be a death penalty. Now how do we agree on it on our agency? And the answer is that I say to you, how much is it worth to you? All right, well, we've done careful market research, and we figured that if we could guarantee that in dealing with your firm, we would get a pro-death penalty court, we could get about another $2 million a year income from our customers, who would be willing to pay more for this higher quality service. So it's worth less than $2 million a year to your customers. Surely there's some offer we can make you that you'll accept to agree to our court. If it's worth more than $2 million, do your customers have it your way? Make us an offer. All right? So that in effect, each of the enforcement firms is bargaining on behalf of its customers to try to get the law enforced. And the amount it's willing to offer is going to reflect the value to the customers of getting the law they want, and you will therefore tend to generate what an economist would call efficient law, meaning those legal rules where the sum value to people who are in favor of them, of getting them, is greater than the sum value to those who are against them, not getting them. Standard economic model of efficiency. Forget about Pareto. Pareto is only a way of pretending you're not making your personal comparisons than you are. Go back to Alfred Marshall, who really thought up the idea and got it right. That's not obvious. I can point you to my Left Price Theory textbook, which goes into some detail about economic efficiency. But that's the basic argument. It's not perfect. I have a discussion elsewhere, which I'm not going to get into, of market theory on that market, because no markets are perfect. But nonetheless, it is a system where, in some sense, the first approximation, it is in the private, selfish interest of people making law to get it right, to make those laws that human beings want to live under. That is not true of executive society. I think it should be pretty obvious by textual observation. So that just seems to be one big advantage to them. Now, you might say, well, why does irrational ignorance operate here just as operates in the political system? And the answer is that in the political system, when I get information in order how to vote, I'm having a small effect on what all of you get. But on the market system, when I gather information to decide whether the legal rules enforced by Court A are better than the ones enforced by Court B, I then pick my enforcement agency to be one that, so far as possible, patronizes the preferred set of legal rules. So just as in ordinary private markets, the benefit to me of finding out which product is better goes to me, and it's in my interest to do it. I like to describe it by imagining how not to sell automobiles. All right. Suppose that instead of our present system for each person deciding what car he wants to buy and buy it, we put people into groups of 100,000 people. Do it by alphabetical order of names. All right. All the people whose names are between Aardvark and Abel, 100,000. And we say, all right, all of you have said that you want to buy a car. You've got a month. Do any research you like. At the end of the month, we're going to take a vote and decide which car all of us will buy. How much time and effort do you spend test driving cars? Right, zero. Because 100,000 people, if you figure out what the right car is, the chance that your vote will decide what you get is almost zero, so you might as well spend your time in test driving. Whereas under the normal system, where each person decides for himself, you have an incentive to gather information to test drive cars, to read consumer reports. Similarly here, with law produced on the market, you have an incentive to figure out on net which rights enforcement agencies do the best job at the lowest cost. Unlike the political case, you can actually compare, because some of your neighbors have one agency and some another. A different problem with the political system is that you can never know how what you got by voting for candidate A, if he got elected, compares to what you would have gotten for B. Because only one of them got elected. We don't get to compare the Obama administration of 2008 with the McCain administration of 2008. We only get one of them. And that means that even after the fact, you think about our present economic woes. Suppose optimistically things get better. The supporters of Obama will say, look, we were faced with a dreadful crisis that could have brought us into the Great Depression. Obama did these wonderful things. He ran, stimulus and all the rest of that data. The opponents of Obama will say, look, it wasn't a terrible catastrophe. Anyway, we were going to get better. Probably we'd have gotten better faster. We had messed things up by all this deficit spending and regulation and so forth. And nobody will ever know. Not literally nobody. A professional might form an expert opinion on that question, but the ordinary voter will never know, because we can't actually see the alternative. Whereas you can try driving two different kinds of cars, see whether your car broke down more than your neighbor's, and in the system I'm describing, you can try, in effect, two different rights enforcement agencies, or know how your neighbor's rights enforcement agency is doing. So that seems to me to be a fairly strong argument in favor of the system I'm describing, a reason to believe that if it works, and I still haven't answered all the reasons why it might not, but why if it works, it looks as though it's a much more attractive way of generating enforcing law than the methods we used. Now, let's look at reasons why it might not work. And there are a number of possibilities, but I want to focus on what seems to be the most serious one, which is what I think of as the stability problem. Suppose that in this marketplace there are only three rights enforcement agencies in the present territory of the U.S. It seems to be entirely possible that the heads of those agencies will get the idea that robbery is really more profitable than production and reinvent government. That after all, they've got the equivalent of all the police. They've got the people who are organized to punish criminals. So if they all merge or if they form some kind of a cartel, then they can say, well, sorry, it used to be that you could change providers. But we've now decided that if you're our customer now, you're our customer forever, and the other guys won't have you. each of them has decided the same thing, and by the way, we've just doubled our rates. And we aren't going to call them taxes, but now it's become taxes. So there's a real stability problem if you have a small number of agencies. And the stability problem is the risk that they will stop interacting on a voluntary market under voluntary market rules and start using their combined tools. This risk is very much less serious if you have 200 agencies. If you have 200 agencies, if two or three or four of them decide to start violating the rights of their customers, the customers will hire somebody else to protect them from them. So that raises for economists the question of what are economies of scale going to be like in the rights enforcement agency. Alright? If economies of scale are such that a firm protecting 80 million people can do a much better job than a firm protecting 1 million people, then we're going to tend to end up in an equilibrium with a very small number of firms, natural monopoly or something close to natural monopoly. We're going to slide back to government, and what's the point of abolishing government if we're going to get it again in another form shortly thereafter? And I think in figuring out what the economies of scale are, it's worth noticing that there are really two rather different goods that your agency is producing. The one which matters when the system is running smoothly is hiring, finding out who violated your rights, arranging arbitration, all of the sort of normal mechanisms of police. But there's something else in the background. And this is something when I originally brought up this system I really missed, and it was my attention was called to it by Jim Buchanan's review of my first book, Machinery of Freedom, which is the only review of that book that actually made me think, Jim being the right guy. And he raised the question, let's go back to my death penalty, non-death penalty enforcement agencies. What he wants to know is, does the pro-death penalty agency have to pay the anti-death penalty agency for its agreement to a pro-death penalty rule, or does the anti have to pay the other way? Or in other words, what's the default? We're bargaining. In the bargaining, each agency is offering to pay to get its way. If nobody agrees to a payment, what happens? Right. And that's a very interesting point. You sort of think of bargaining from some starting point. And the normal bargaining in most market situations is very simple. The starting point is you don't do business. Well, in my private market for law, we don't do business means we start shooting each other. Right? If we haven't agreed on an arbitration agency, we're going to have violent conflicts between our customers or between us representing our customers. So what Jim wanted to know is, where's the starting point? Where, and his conclusion in reviewing the book was, if you want to solve that, the system bounces fine. You can go generate on the market efficient law, but where is the point where both parties understand start funds we don't go on? And I think there are basically two answers. The most fundamental answer is that underlying this society and all other societies is a mutual threat game. That everybody knows that if we can't reach agreement, we'll start shooting each other. That's an unattractive option. If I can persuade you that I'm willing to do that, that I'm less scared of violence than you are, maybe you'll get into my preferences in regard to the law. I say every society, because if you really think of a society like ours, it's sort of a puzzle how our society works. We're all used to it. But why do people go along with things? Why do people agree to accept the decisions of the law? Why don't they shoot at each other? And part of the answer, I think, is that one of the things underlying this society is the feeling if the majority pushes things too far, some minorities would start shooting. Or maybe they leave, and immigration is another possibility. But that somehow everybody knows that underneath all peaceful societies, there is sort of the potential for civil war, disruption, terrorism, and things like that. And that potential constrains what we do our bargaining from in this society. You think about questions like, why hasn't Obama expropriated everything the King owns? Why isn't democratic politics a winner-take-all game? You know, somebody described what happened in Africa after decolonialization. Democracy there was one man, one vote, once. After which the winner sets up a military dictation. Why doesn't that happen? And there are a lot of answers, but part of the answer really is that underlying threat game. So let me go back to my... If the underlying threat game is really important, then it matters how many tanks you have. Then, if my rights enforcement agency is twice as big as yours and has twice as many goons on staff, when we demand that we get the law our way, you may get in. On the other hand, if that, in that case, you're getting kind of just, you know, that dangerous dream I just described. On the other hand, if you imagine, if you think about international affairs at the moment, because after all, what's going on between governments is a mutual threat game too. And yet, somehow, you don't observe that every time that one government buys a new battleship, the border shifts by half a mile. That every time that one government gets a somewhat better or worse military, the border shifts by half a mile. It looks as though in games like that, there's an enormous inertia, an enormous tendency towards accepting the status quo. Because everybody knows that war is expensive, war is dangerous, so therefore, and the status quo ends up serving as what Thomas Schelling introduced the idea of Schelling point, sort of unique outcomes that people can focus on because the alternative is constant. If it works that way in my system, and I think it would if the system is one sort of established before used to it, then the default rule is whatever the legal rule was yesterday. Then you have a status quo bias, and what you say is, all right, we've always had an agreement on a court which believes in capital punishment. If you want to change that, you've got to take me. Or alternatively the other way. So I think one of the important questions, which I didn't realize when I really thought this up, but it's come since, is do you have the kind of system in which the resort to violence is not really a serious option to most people most of the time? And if anybody starts doing it, people will shoot them or stop dealing with them or whatever. Or you have the sort of thing which everybody sees that as in the background. Former case, it seems to me that simple rights enforcement does not have very much economy to scale. We don't observe that big city police departments do a better job at a lower cost than small city police departments, which suggests that you don't have economy to scale. If you do, you do. I'm left, finally, with the problem of, if we have this system, how do we provide the really important public goods, of which the clearest case, I would say the only serious case, I think, is national defense. Where by national defense, I mean defense against other nations. And we then go back to the fact that public goods, in fact, get provided privately quite often. I should mention radio isn't actually relevant to this one, but it's still relevant in general, that after The Economist has proved that radio broadcasts can't be produced privately because it's a pure public good with a large public, he can then turn on the radio and discover that indeed they're being produced privately. How are they being done? Because some unknown genius thought up the idea of producing not one public good, but two. One of the public goods has positive cost of production and positive value to the consumer, and we call it a program. And one of them has negative cost of production and negative value to the consumer, we call that an advertisement. Tie the two tightly together and give away the bundle. And the producer gets paid by the advertisers enough to pay the cost of the program, and the consumers are willing to listen to the ad as part of the price of the program. So that's one example. But there are a whole lot of other examples, which I could go into if this were to talk about public goods instead of about anarchy, of imperfect ways in which people on private markets, in fact, produce public goods. I actually know somebody who's a scientist who argues that basic research in practice can be reduced privately, and that the reason is that the only people who really understand the implications of the basic research are the researchers who are doing it, and the only people the researchers really want to talk to about it are the other researchers who are doing it, and it therefore pays a firm to have some of its employees doing, in some sense, useless basic research in order to have a contact by which they can figure out what's going on in the basic research, which will eventually apply research. So what about national defense? And when I wrote my book back 37 years ago, that struck me as a really hard problem. And you could certainly think of ways you could raise some resources for national defense. Charity is one obvious one. And in fact, charity is one of the ways we do pay for national defense, that when there's a war going on, at least a popular war, traditionally people volunteer for the army even though they're being paid well below market wage. When things are desperate, people donate firearms to the military. It happened in England during the early parts of World War II when they were distinctly short of military equipment, having left a lot of it behind in France after Dunkirk. Things of that happen. Israel, of course, sells bonds which the buyers know are a bad investment because the buyers are patriotic. supporters of Israel. So some of that does happen. And one can think of other mechanisms. Tipping for restaurants. All right, if you think about it, tipping restaurants, even more taxicabs, looks an awful lot like producing a public good. Because what are you producing? You're giving the cab driver and the restaurant waiter an incentive to treat their customers well. But unless you're a regular at that restaurant, it's not going to give you much benefit. Why do we do it? Because of some sort of a social pressure where if you don't do it, your friends will look odd at you. You cheated him. You stiffed the cab driver. I don't like people like that. You can imagine mechanisms of that sort raising some amount of money. How much, you don't know. When I wrote the book, the Soviet Union was still a going concern. And the result was that the U.S. really had a potential enemy who had cost quite a lot to defend against. Defending against invasions from Canada or Mexico is much cheaper. All right, so I think there is a very real sense in which the U.S., what is now the U.S., in my future, of course, the U.S. doesn't exist, a government, but the territory could defend itself against likely aggressors at a much lower cost than it could have 30 years ago. Low enough, I don't know. Let me describe the model I came up with since then for how you could imagine. There's only one possible way of imagining a national defense in an anarchist capitalist society. And my model is partly inspired by the open source movement, which is that kind of thing if you think about it. It's partly inspired by a very weird Rudyard Kipling story called The Army of a Dream, which I can tell you if you're curious about, and by a number of other things. Also partly inspired by things like paintball, Society for Creative Anachronism, a bunch of other things people do. But the basic idea, also partly inspired by the founders of this country's solution to some problems they face. The basic idea is we have a military that consists of two parts. There is a small cadre of professional soldiers paid for essentially by charity, by donations, by people who want to show that they're good members of the society. There is then a very large militia of people who are doing it mostly for fun. That's where the paintball comes in. So that you imagine people whose idea of a fun way of spending a weekend is going out doing military maneuvers done in the form of war games against other teams of the same sort with some referees who are scoring it. This is a story Kipling tells, by the way. Kipling is an imaginary England I look for World War I, where essentially war games have replaced cricket as a national sport, with the result that practically every adult male is a trained soldier for the fun of the visit. Of course, the fun of it plus patriotism in the English version. And he then wakes up at the end of the story and realizes that none of this really happened, and the guy who was telling him about it, in fact, got killed in the Boer War. And he sees the bullet hole in the forehead of the guy he's talking to. It's a weird story. Pretty good story. The Army of a Dream. Anyway, so in this system, the basic idea is that what the cadre serves two functions. In peacetime, they maintain enough standardization so the militia units can work with each other, so that they make the rules of what caliber of guns we use and what frequency of our radio transmit on and that sort of stuff. And the militias obey those rules not because they make them, but because, you know, you want to play with each other, essentially. But also because I'm imagining a society which is whose inhabitants like it and therefore see it as a good thing to defend it. It doesn't cost too much. Some of the stuff is likely to be funded by private firms, because after all, when we have our Independence Day celebration on April 15th, which of course will be the national holiday in the future, the Apple computer sends its team of 200 Apple employees who are volunteer militia with the Apple flag flying above them, and they make it clear that because Apple is the kind of company you want to do business with, it sees its obligation to protect against the fact that invaders if they ever show up, and it therefore gives its people a certain amount of paid free time and helps buy their uniforms and stuff, with of course the Apple logo on them and stuff like that. So I think you can plausibly imagine at some level of defense, not clear how much, some system where you're using volunteers who are doing it for some combination of the fact that paintball would be a whole lot more fun if part of what you thought you were doing was training to defend your homeland if an enemy ever came, and things like charity, good PR for the firms that are subsidizing their employees to do things of that sort of stuff. And I think if you look at paintball or Society of Creative Anachronism or other things when people are doing war games for fun, as it were, it's quite likely that you could have a militia in the millions of people available. And this then gets us back to the solution that the founders of this country found for a problem which is connected to Moses. And that's the problem of the Special Army. That by the end of the 18th century, it was, I think, pretty obvious that professionals beat amateurs in military affairs. And it was also pretty obvious that professional armies were dangerous. Because, as you will all remember, in the middle of the 17th century, England had a war, a civil war. That civil war was ended when Cromwell's new model army defeated the royalist forces. They then had a second civil war. And the second civil war had everybody else on one side and Cromwell, the new model army, on the other side, and Cromwell won. And made himself dictator in England for the next 15 years or so. Lord Protector. He did a good job as far as I know. He was a competent tyrant. But if you're somebody writing the U.S. Constitution, it may occur to you that you've got a problem. That if you don't defend your country with a substantial professional army, how will you defend it? And if you do, how will you protect the country against that army? And my interpretation of the Second Amendment is that the solution they came up with is to have a small professional army and a big militia, which is very good, but there's lots of it. So in the case of war, the size of the militia makes up for its amateur status, and you've got the professionals to lead it. And in the case of a coup d'etat, while it is true that the professionals are much better than the amateurs outnumber the professionals 100 to 1. And part of the Second Amendment is that you have a legal requirement that you allow the amateurs to stay armed, because as long as they stay armed, they are a sufficient counterweight against the threat of the professionals. That's my partly conjectural interpretation of why the Second Amendment was designated. Well, I'm really setting up something analogous to that. It's the same basic idea of you have enough of the expert professionals to do the things that you really need professionals for, but you heavily outnumber them, and that way the risk that whoever you organize to defend your country will decide to rule it instead gets minimized. So that's basically the story I'm telling. Now, I don't want to claim to have proved in any way that an anarcho-capitalist society would work under all circumstances, because it probably wouldn't. What I'm claiming is that it ought to be considered among the serious options for social organization, along with mixed economy capitalism, maybe some versions of welfare state socialism, and so forth, that under some circumstances it would work, and if it worked, it would probably be more attractive than the other alternative. If it worked in the sense of not getting conquered, not falling to an internal coup by the agencies, that you then have a system in which you actually have a reason to expect the government to do good things. Well, it's not the government anymore, but the people doing things the government traditionally do to do good things to generate good ones. And that's really the claim I'm making. Last question is, how do you get there from here? My chapter on this in the book starts out with subtitle, "You Can't Get There From Here." Old joke, I hope. And I can see two models. One of them is in real space and one of them is in cyberspace. And the model in real space is that you basically persuade people that governments don't do things very well. We were making some progress on that up to a few years ago. And you thus persuade people that more and more things should be privatized. And in some cases, rather than first persuading them to privatize things, you start out by setting up a private firm that's doing what everybody thought only the government could do, and as it becomes more and more obvious that it's doing it, the argument for the government doing it becomes less and less. So FedEx and UPS would be the obvious example, where they pretty obviously would be better off if we abolished the post office tomorrow. In fact, the post office is better than it would be without FedEx and UPS, because the competition is forcing to do something closer to it after the competition. Cyberspace is very interesting, and that would be another talk which I'm not giving, but if people are interested, you can find stuff on my webpage. But there are technologies associated with public key encryption, for any of you who are familiar with it, which make it possible to have a level of privacy online that we've never had in real space. You could have a world where you could have an online identity doing all sorts of things, making contracts, selling services, and nobody but you could find out what real person was connected to that online identity. It's very hard to arrest somebody if you don't know who he is. So you have at least the possibility of building an online market anarchist society, in which enforcement will be entirely by reputational mechanisms, like the fair courts of old, not by the use of force, as it were, simultaneously with the real world, real space, governmental economy. And if we end up in a future where most of our life is spent in cyberspace, which is entirely possible if you think about virtual reality as it exists, you may even know people who spend more of their time in the World of Warcraft than they do in the real world, and you can imagine that going further and further as the technology gets better and better. In that world, you know, a tenth of your life is lived under the rule of government in real space, and nine-tenths of it is lived under private law in cyberspace. Going a little further, the more of your life is lived in cyberspace, the less power governments have in real space, because the more of your life is lived in cyberspace, the more mobile you are. That I can fly off to Paris and join the same World of Warcraft raid that I would have been joining in San Jose. Have continued the same online conversations with people I would have been having. So to the extent that we are shifting to an online world where governments have little control, which is at least a possible future, not a certain future, we could also be shifting to a world where governments are more and more in the position of a hotel that's got to provide its customers with a good combination of price and product, because the customers will leave if they don't. I think I've gone just over my hour, but now I'm ready for the discussion. Thank you. Somebody got me some water, by the way. I'm dry. That is talking to me today. Adam Smith, when he wrote The Wealth of Nations, published in 1776, The Importance of Evidence. years, you know, that he wrote, it is more likely, this isn't an exact quote, but it's something like, it's more likely that we would establish the utopia of war than that England would ever abolish its restrictions on foreign trade. Less than 70 years after that, England went to free trade. Partly due to Smith. So that's the case where he underestimated where he was. The other case is a much, in a sense, a much milder one. Ronald Coase, a very important economist, law person, wrote a piece, I suppose, 1950-ish, about the Federal Communications Commission, in which he was saying that what we ought to do is to turn the airways into private property. And what we ought to do, instead of saying the government will give you permission to broadcast on this frequency as long as you're doing it in the public interest, which is a really crazy way of handling an information media in a society that believes the government shouldn't decide what newspapers print, but it gets to decide whether you get this very valuable permission to broadcast or whether it proves you or not. And what he said, no, just auction it off. And whoever gets the most gets the right to broadcast on this frequency. He can subdivide it into part of it on the West Coast and part of it on the East Coast. He can rent it out at different hours with just pretty ordinary private property. At the time he published that, I think a number of economists would say, well, this is a very clever writing, but there's just no way that's ever going to happen. It's just very current standard U.S. policy. Policy in a less extreme version than Coase wanted it, so that the FCC decides these frequencies are for cell phones and then auction them off. These frequencies are for this. It would be better if they said, we're going to auction off the right to use these frequencies, to decide what their highest value use is. And so far they've been unwilling to do that. But nonetheless, to a substantial degree, it's a completely crazy idea. My guess is that I tend to be too optimistic, so I will try to be pessimistic. But we're not going to deal with that. And of course, the other thing is it's a big world. So that one could certainly imagine what I'm describing occurring in some area where, for whatever reason, there weren't strong foreign threats. I think Costa Rica, if I'm not mistaken, has no armed forces. Pretty sure it's Costa Rica. And that's obviously impossible. But apparently there's nobody who really wants to invade Costa Rica and not for it to be a problem. Similarly, I've written about sort of my favorite historical society in terms of interest, which was Sagaviri, Iceland, which was not quite an anarcho-capitalist because it had a legislature and a court system, but it had no executive arm of government. So that after you got your verdict, it left you to the And I think that looking at how that system works helps answer some questions about the system I described because it has some of the features and all the features. On the other hand, Iceland was also an isolated island, well off in the Atlantic, and for most of that period they didn't really face any serious foreign threat. And they, two times when they did were when the North was going Christian, and Iceland was pagan, and the King of Norway was Christian, and was in various ways trying to pressure the Icelanders to convert. And the Icelanders ended up with a Christian minority feuding with the pagan majority. A few people were killed, people were happy about this, and they went to the annual Althing, the annual assembly, and the two sides declared themselves out of law with each other. In effect, the state said, my rights in West Asia no longer have a contract. At which point, Cooler had prevailed, and they decided this was not a good idea. And both sides agreed to accept the pagan law speaker, the one sort of official in the system, as an arbitrator. And he decided on Christianity being the official religion with toleration for private but not public pagan worship. Everyone else did. And there were like 10 people killed, on that exact number, in this whole business of converting it. Compare that to the rest of Europe over that same time. And we even get an Icelandic comparison. Because the point at which whoever was then ruling Iceland after the system had broken down 700 years later went from Catholic to Lutheran. They then made Iceland go from Catholic to Lutheran, and there were like 50 people killed or 10 people killed on the process of that conflict. Then you're a nice modern system in the beginning. I guess my thoughts kind of depression. I guess all I'm saying is one could imagine various versions of what's happening in pockets, as it were, even if not. And there's a certain sense in which I argue that our present system for dealing with auto accidents has some of the logical structure, economic structure of an out-of-capital system, in the sense that just as the private firms in my system have the alternative of arbitration or warfare, so auto insurance companies, which are continually facing the case of my customer versus your customer, have the alternative of arbitration or litigation. The equivalent of warfare is actually going to court. It's expensive just like warfare is. And in fact, virtually all such cases are settled without going to court. In almost all auto accident cases, the insurance companies have worked out rules with each other on here's how we decide who pays who how much, and we let them. So that's sort of an example of the sort of sort of thing before we reach a reasonable effect. Other comments?
Real quick. With cyberspace, there's some promise that governments won't be able to see how money is moving around, so won't be able to tax.
One of the ways we've been too optimistic is I thought by now we would have an honesty. Basically, the technical problems were worked out a long time ago by a Dutch cryptographer named David Chow. And we know how to set up a system where you have a bank somewhere, and I can make payments to you in a fashion such that as if money I had on deposit in the bank is now in your name. But you don't have to know who I am. I don't have to know who you are. The bank doesn't have to know who your name is. And if you look at my book, Future Imperfect, which is also on my webpage, I actually sketch out a low-tech version of how you could do that just to demonstrate it's possible, although what Chow has is a much more mathematical and elaborate system for doing that. In order to do that, all you require is a bank or equivalent in some country where A, people trust its institutions so they believe it will just walk away with their money, and B, where the U.S. and its allies can't put enough pressure on it to stop it. Because once you have anonymous e-cash, money laundering laws become unenforceable. Because you can now make invisible cash transactions of any size. And the U.S. government would not like that to happen. Other governments would like that to happen. I have hopes that maybe China will do it. The nice thing about China is that it is big enough that the U.S. can't push it around and different enough so that it will make different bad laws in the U.S. And with regard to preventing things like e-cash, unless everybody prevents it, nobody prevents it. It's not true of everything, but there are some things, and this is sort of part of my general view on technological progress kinds of things. There are lots of technological changes that are scary, sometimes for good reasons. And on the whole, I would like to have technological change occur in anyone. Average, we're better off, not worse off. Any given government might want to repress it. But unless all the governments repress it, it probably happens. And from that standpoint, a multi-state world where nobody, that's the only way in which the world is worse off than this location collapse. Because it makes it easier for the U.S. to push other governments around, because they don't have the alternative saying, well, you know, if you really try to get after them, maybe we'll start talking to professionals.
Question about, I guess you sort of said that setting up the different arbitration branches would require a status quo.
What I said was that you have to have some way of saying what rules exist between my price point agency and yours if we can't bargain to change the rules. There's some implicit starting point. And it might well be at the starting point if you imagine this sort of system gradually growing up. There's a moderately entertaining science fiction novel called So Crashing, if you've read it, but it's a not too distant future in which the U.S. government no longer exists, but it thinks it does. That is to say, there are buildings with federal employees in it, it's just nobody paying attention to them. And you could imagine that kind of transition in which, at present, a lot of commercial disputes are handled by private arbitration. And it's true that the arbitration in theory is backed by the state, in that if you agree to arbitration and you then don't accept the verdict, the other party may be able to get the same court to enforce it. But a lot of that is just enforced by arbitration. You could imagine a future in which more and more of the fundamental government activities are being done privately, not because the government has decided to privatize. I mean, think about the kind of housing arrangements where you've got a walled community with its own security service. Alright? That's replacing the police. Not because government decided to abolish the police because police weren't doing a good enough job and people decided to do something else. You can imagine a change in which there's no point in which government is abolished. My guess is that if my firm and your firm are negotiating over terms, we will start out with whatever the existing legal rules are. And then say, all right, what changes would you like us to make? Any changes you both like we'll make. Any changes I like you don't, we'll back them. So that's my guess about what would happen in that. If you imagine, though, the catastrophic version, which is much less likely to be an attractive version in which the whole government collapses for some reason or other, and you then have to build it up, then I'd be much more worried about how do we figure out what our starting point is. All right, everybody's got all their questions answered. The rest of the answers are on the webpage, or at least some of them are. Machinery of Freedom is still in print, though at a reasonably high price, unfortunately, because they're doing print on demand.
Thank you all.